I have made a fool of myself, but you drove me to it. I ought to have been commended by you, for I am not in the least inferior to the super apostles, even though I am nothing. The things that mark an apostle, signs, wonders, and miracles, were done among you with great perseverance. How were you inferior to the other churches, except that I was never a burden to you? Forgive me for this wrong. Now I am ready to visit you for a third time, and I will not be a burden to you, because what I want is not your possessions, but you. After all, children should not have to save for their parents, but parents for their children. So I will very gladly spend for you everything I have, and expend myself as well. If I love you more, will you love me less? Be that as it may, I have not been a burden to you. Yet, crafty fellow that I am, I caught you with trickery. Did I exploit you through any of the men I sent you? I urged Titus to go to you, and I sent our brother with him. Titus did not exploit you, did he? Did we not act in the same spirit and follow the same course? Have you been thinking all along that we have been defending ourselves to you? We have been speaking in the sight of God as those in Christ, and everything we do, dear friends, is for your strengthening. For I am afraid that when I come, I may not find you as I want you to be, and you may not find me as you want me to be. I fear that there may be quarreling, jealousy, outbursts of anger, factions, slander, gossip, arrogance, and disorder. I'm afraid that when I come again, my God will humble me before you, and I will be grieved over many who have sinned early and have not repented of their impurity, sexual sin, and debauchery in which they have indulged.
Do you love the church? I love lots of things. I love my family. I've just become an American. I can start crying now, can't I? I love my family. But I love Milky Way yogurt thingies. And there's one in the fridge at the moment. So I'm looking forward to that when I go home. Pardon? Milky Bar. Thank you. I love those. There's lots of things we love, there's lots of things we enjoy, there's lots of things we appreciate, there's lots of things and people in particular that we care about. But the question that this section poses for us really is, do we love the church? Do we really love the church? Do we love the people of the church? Do we really love the people of the church? Do we really care about their spiritual progress? Do we love the work of the church? Like we really care whether the work of the church progresses, like we care whether it's moving forward, whether good things are happening or rubbish things are happening, whether the reputation of the church is a good reputation, a God-honoring reputation, or whether it's tarnished, whether it's spoilt. Do you love the church? Do you love the church like Paul loves the church? That's what we get to think about in this section. It has the general title, Never a Burden to You. Let's look, first of all, at verses 11 through to 13, where Paul says, in my rather snappy title, I didn't want to be a burden to you in the past, even though I'm an apostle. Couldn't think of an easier way of saying that. That's what it says. I didn't want to be a burden to you in the past, when I visited you in the past, even though I was a true apostle. Paul says, I deserved your support. There was no reason that you shouldn't have given me any support, but I didn't want to call on that support. And because I'm an apostle, you should welcome me. You should have welcomed me. You should welcome the message that I'm bringing now. And he says, he explains, as he has a number of times, that he's been foolish in a way. He's been kind of acting the part of a fool in the last sections as he's been defending his ministry. Verse 11, I've made a fool of myself, but you drove me to it. I've been kind of arguing in a way to justify myself, but I know this is foolish. As you'll say a bit later on, it's before Christ I stand or fall. That's really what matters. It's really foolishness to try and argue about my rights or my authority or any of those things. But he says, you drove me to it by your behavior, by your attitude, by what you're saying about me, by the way you're elevating these super apostles. You drove me to do that. But he says, you should have recognized my authority. I ought to, middle of verse 11, I ought to have been commended by you, for I am not in the least inferior to the super apostles, even though I'm nothing. Paul's humble about the fact that he is in himself nothing, that there's nothing special about him, there's nothing unique about his gifting in one sense. Humanly speaking, he says, I am nothing. I'm a sinner. I'm the worst of all sinners, as he says elsewhere, chief of sinners. So he says, I am nothing, but you should have recognized my apostolic authority. I'm not inferior to the people that you're elevating at Corinth. The people that you're thinking are like super guys. They're so good at preaching and they've got all this kind of spectacular ministry. And Paul's already argued, we've been looking at it the past weeks, about how his ministry compares and how his weakness is actually a strength because it's the strength of Christ showing through. He's argued all that and makes this conclusion now. I'm not at all inferior to them. And he looks back in the past and says, you should have seen it when I was with you. The things that mark an apostle, signs, wonders, and miracles, were done among you with great perseverance. In other words, over a long time. It wasn't just one miracle. There were loads of miracles and signs and wonders. There was nothing inferior. I'm not the least inferior to the super apostles because there was nothing inferior about my ministry among you. Verse 13, how were you inferior to other churches except that I was never a burden to you? Their experience in Corinth wasn't inferior to anyone else. Like the other churches that Paul went to, there was nothing inferior in what they experienced of apostolic ministry. But also, it wasn't inferior to what perhaps they're now getting from the super apostles. Can you see that? He uses inferior twice there. I'm not inferior to the super apostles, and the ministry you got wasn't inferior to anything else, anywhere else. It says the only difference, and here he uses kind of great irony, sarcasm. He says, the only difference was that I was never a burden to you. You know, the only difference with other places is that I didn't charge you any money. I didn't ask you for any money. You didn't have to support me at all. That was the only difference. And really, of course, that was a benefit, if anything. That's why he says, forgive me that wrong. Ultimately, we should never boast in ourselves. Paul kind of is driven to it and kind of argues around it as if he's about to really make a great boast about himself in the previous sections, but he never quite gets there because when he gets to the kind of crescendo of his boasting, of course, he just talks about his weakness. We should never boast about ourselves. We should never claim to be what we're not, as some of these super apostles were. But I guess it does show that there is a rightness in recognizing gifting, in recognizing what has been done. Paul uses very passive language in the way he writes, particularly in the original language, where he says, the things that mark an apostle, signs, wonders, and miracles, were done among you with great perseverance. And the way that's constructed, it's not like I did among you. He's saying, these things God did among you. These things happened among you. They were happening through my ministry, but not really through me. They were through the power of God. And it is right. When good things happen, we don't say, I had a highly successful ministry, or I serve the Lord in these remarkable ways, or I have this remarkable gifting. But we do say, God did great things through us in the past. If that happened, we recognize it. And we praise God for it. We do recognize those things. So there is a realism that Paul shows here. But he doesn't stand up for his rights. You know, Paul, amongst anybody else, would be someone who could stand up for his rights. But he doesn't. More than that, he seeks not to be a burden to them. Clearly, what he's saying is the super apostles, the highly charged, spectacular ministers, were a burden. Because, I don't know if you remember from a few weeks ago, but that word burden is often used of a financial burden. You know, we talk about in English, about being burdened with debt. It's that kind of idea that I was never a burden to you in that sense. The super apostles obviously wanted some recognition. They wanted some dosh. They wanted some money for their spectacular gifts and the service and their rhetoric and all those things. Now, what he's saying, and he'll continue to say, but he's starting to give us an insight into it already, is that what I'm about is not about my gifts, and actually it's not about me being recognized. It's about preaching the gospel to you and serving you. I want to be what you might call a net contributor to the church. I want to give to the church. You'll talk about that a little bit more in the section coming up. I don't want to be a burden to you, even though I have rights and authority. Secondly, I will not be a burden when I visit because I love the church, verses 14 through to 18. So he talks about the past, and then he talks about his visit coming up in these next two sections. And he says, I haven't been a burden to you in the past, and I won't be a burden to you in the future when I come to you. And the reason that I won't be a burden is because I love the church. Mark and I often talk about what we're going to preach about in the coming Sunday. So we meet on a Wednesday, often in the afternoons. And almost invariably, we sit down, we have a chat, and he talks about what he's going to preach about, and then I talk about what I'm going to preach about, or vice versa. And almost invariably, we kind of get into the other person's sermon and say, oh yeah, I'd really love to preach your sermon, because it sounds really good, you know, and stuff like that. And then he says, oh, I'd really like to preach your sermon. I can see... And this was a kind of funny week when Mark said, I don't really want to preach your sermon, because there's not a lot in it, really. But then when you get to this particular section here, in these verses, it suddenly kind of takes off. And you just get a moment of the pastoral heart of Paul. And it's only a few phrases, but they're just gold in this section. A few phrases about how he feels about the church in Corinth. So he says, verse 14, I'm ready to visit you. I'm coming to visit you a third time. Remember, he'd been there twice already. And there's the combination of the various letters that we talked about quite a lot as we worked through. But here he is. He's coming to visit them again. And he talks about how he's going to be, that first of all, he's not going to be a burden to them. But then he talks about how he feels about them. He says, I'm not going to be asking for your financial support. That won't be necessary. And then he gives a reason, because what I want is not your possessions, but you. That's a remarkable phrase. I don't want your possessions. The reason I want to come and visit you is not because I want your money. It's because I want you. I want to see you. I want to know how you're progressing. He says, I feel a certain parentage after all, he says. Children shouldn't have to save up for their parents, but parents for their children. Parents, you need to save up for your children. Children generally don't have to save up for their parents. I know there's all the kind of costs of putting people in homes and everything in the future that nowadays children have to think about, maybe, but so you can think about that, children. But generally speaking, we provide for our children, don't we? That's the norm, that we save up and, you know, we think about how much money do we need for them to go to university, or, you know, can we give them a bit of help in their first house or whatever it is. I didn't do any of those things. But in general, that's what we want to do, isn't it? We save up. We buy them their next pair of shoes. We buy them their school uniform, all that kind of thing. And Paul says, it's like that with the church. You know, you shouldn't be paying for me. We don't expect our sort of primary age child, you know, to start paying the weekly shopping bill, do we? He says, parents save up for their children. Parents make provision for their children. I want to give to you. I have that feeling about you. Like a parent to a child. And then Paul has this other remarkable phrase in this section. Verse 15. So I will very gladly spend for you everything I have and expend myself as well. If I love you more, will you love me less? That's like the verse. It's like the verse of the section. I will give up everything for you. Everything I've got, everything I own, everything I have, I will gladly give it up for you. Not I will grudgingly give it up for you. Not you've been such a pain that I'm going to have to give it to you. He says, I will gladly give you all my possessions. And then he gets even more intense when he says, and I'll give myself as well. I'll give myself away. I'll give you all that I have. I'll preach to you. I'll pray for you. I'll pray about things that are happening in Corinth. I'll try and instruct you. I'll confront your sin. I'll do everything for you. I'll give myself over to you. You want my time? I'll give you my time. I will give you myself. I will give you my love. I will love you more. And then he kind of raises that probing question. Will you love me less? I will love you more. I want to love you more than I'm loving you at the moment. And are you going to love me less in return? And he very articulately and again with great irony just kind of puts off the table any suggestion that he's coming to them to get some money, or that the trip that Titus made with one described as the faithful brother, we spoke about that earlier, as they came and made a collection for the churches. So they came to Corinth, made a collection for other churches in Judea that were in need. He wants to get completely off the table that there was anything going on there to do with possessions. He wants to not just for it to be in a kind of emotional statement, you know, that I'll give you myself, but he wants to make sure that they remember there was complete transparency in all his financial dealings with them. Yes, there was a collection, and yes, it was for the churches elsewhere. It wasn't for him. There was no trickery. There was no exploitation in comparison to what he feels the super apostles are doing. So verse 17, did I exploit you through any of the men I sent to you? I urged Titus to go to you, and I sent our brother with him, someone else who went with Titus. Titus did not exploit you, did he? Did we not act in the same spirit and follow the same course? So just like, transparently, Titus and the brother who went there did not exploit them, Paul says, I did not exploit you. I will not exploit you. I love you, and I want to love you more. Will you love me less? And I think it just very simply, very plainly puts out there for us the question, do you love the church? And if you do, what's it like? What's it like loving the church? How is loving the church for you? Will you say, I will gladly spend all my money? I will gladly give up everything for the good of the church. And you say, well, God hasn't called me to it yet. But what if he did? How would you know if he was anyway? And what's your kind of baseline attitude? Would you say, like Paul, I would give up everything for the church, but more than perhaps to do with your possessions, will you go with Paul on his expression, and I will give myself, I will gladly expend myself for the church? We try and teach discipline in financial matters to our children, don't we? We try and learn it for ourselves, that there's a control, there's a measure. We try not to buy too many pairs of shoes. We try not to spend too much money on food or holidays. We try and control our expenditure. And we can often kind of take that into the church and think, well, you know, here's a line item in our kind of financial accounts. I'm going to give this much to the church, and it's very measured, and it's controlled, and I can afford it, and that's cool. And we have a kind of financial line in our giving of ourselves to say, well, I don't want to overdo it, And we can make all the good qualifications about not burning ourselves out and taking Sabbath rest and all those kind of things. But having said all of those, is there still a sense in which we say, I will give a bit of myself to the church? And I will control how much I give to the church. And I won't expend myself too much. I won't overdo it. I won't wear myself out. Do you love the church? Are you excessive in your giving of yourself and your possessions and your time and your prayers and your love to the church? Or are you controlled and miserly and accountancy-wise with the church? So would you say, like Paul, I want to love you more? You know, here I am, at this point in time in my relationship with the church, people who have gathered here, the wider group of the church, I'm here. You know, what's my goal for the coming year? I will love you more, I will love you less. I think I'm loving you enough. Would you say that? I think I'm loving you enough. It's just about right. I'm giving just about the right amount of money. It's hurting a little bit, but not too much. I'm giving just about the right amount of time. You know, it's a little bit tiring, but I'm not overdoing it. And I will love you as much as I am already. Do you want to say that? I will love you as much as I am already. And of course, when you say that, you know it's ridiculous. Because you know that you could love more. And I want you to join with Paul and say, I will love you more. And kind of put it out there. Will you love me less? Will the church be worse off if you love the church more? Will there be less love in the church because you love people more? Paul loves the church. It's so obvious. His heart is for the church. He cares about the church. And do you love the church for the people who are in it? Because the people who are in it are precious people to Jesus Christ. Because Jesus loved the church. And he was not controlled. He was not miserly. He was not limited in his giving for the church, was he? What did Christ do? Christ loved the church and gave a bit of himself. He gave all of himself. He gave himself for the church. He's happy to do the Father's will. Here I am, he says, in the words of that psalm, I have come to do your will. And he gives of his life, the ultimate giving of himself, the ultimate really completion of Paul's words, I will gladly spend all my possessions and I will gladly spend myself for you. He's only really saying what Jesus does excessively, because Jesus gives up everything. Does Jesus give up his possessions? Of course he does. He gives up the glory of heaven for living on earth, and not living on earth as a rich bloke, but as a poor bloke, who by the end has nothing, even his clothes are taken away. He has nothing at the end. He gives up all his possessions, and he gives up his life. He expends his life for the church. And so all Paul is doing is saying, I want to be like Jesus, because that's what Jesus feels about the church. And that's how I feel about you. And is that how you feel about the church? And you feel about the church in that way because Christ loved and died for every member of the church. And we want the people of the church. We don't want to be in the church for what the church gives us. Sometimes it really helps us. Sometimes we love the support of the church. Sometimes we love just the encouragement of being with friends and family in the church. That's a great thing. Sometimes we love the advice that people in the church give us. But Paul says, it's not that. I want you. I want you as people. I want to know you as people. I want to love you as people. Do you love the church? Do you look forward to seeing the church? Do you look forward to meeting with people from the church? Do you look forward to opportunities to encourage and to be encouraged? Paul says, I won't be a burden to you when I visit because I love the church. And then lastly, I fear a burden. I fear the burden of discovering when I come to visit you about your sin. Verses 19 through to 21. Paul says, I stand before Christ, and my burden is not that I will be ashamed before Christ. I'm not burdened in that way. I wasn't a burden to you, and I'm not worried. I don't fear the judgment before Christ. That's not what I'm fearing. You see, he says, have you been thinking all along that we've been defending ourselves to you? It's a very interesting clarification he makes, isn't it? You see, you might have thought through some of the letters, says Paul, through some of my writings, that I'm trying to defend myself to you, like I'm trying to justify myself to you. And he says, I'm not really. Because I know it's before God that I am justified or not. And he says, I've been speaking in the sight of God. I haven't really, in a way, been talking to you. I've been opening my heart before God. And as someone in Christ, as a group of people who are ministering in Christ, he says, everything we've done, has been for your strengthening. It's all been for you and for you to grow up in Christ. So he says, I don't have a worry. I don't have a fear about that. I know I'm not perfect, and he's not saying that at all. But he's saying that's not my worry. What my worry is, what my fear is that I might come and discover that there's still sin going on. And that would be painful, and that would be humiliating to me. It's very interesting language, again, that he uses, where he says, I fear that I might come amongst you and be humbled before you. And first of all, you think, he means he might be humble because they're not listening to him, or he might be humble because they point out some faults in him, or he's not as impressive as he might be, and all those kind of things. You think that's what he might be talking about, but what he actually says is that I fear I might be humbled because of your sin. See verse 20, I'm afraid that when I come to you, I may not find you as I want you to be, and you may not find me as you want me to be. I fear there may be quarrelling, jealousy, outbursts of anger, faction, slander, gossip, arrogance, and disorder. I'm afraid that when I come again, my God will humble me before you, and I will be grieved over many who have sinned earlier and have not repented of the impurity, sexual sin, and debauchery in which they've indulged. I'm not worried that I'm going to be humbled by my sin. I'm worried that I'm going to be humbled by your sin. Can you see that? Fascinating, isn't it? He says, I'm not worried about my gifts being analysed or anything else. I'm really fearful that I'm going to arrive in Corinth and you're arguing, you're disputing, you're disagreeing. And some of you, as he's written about in this letter and the previous letter, are still partying. I'm sure what the idea is of debauchery and sexual immorality. You're still partying, completely excessive partying, sexual license. We know that's a problem in Corinth, fighting inside the church, ungodly lifestyles outside the church. And Paul says, if I see that, I will be grieved. I will be humbled. It will grieve me so much to see sin in the church. And I think, again, Paul is just putting it out there for us as an example of how we should feel about the church. So we love the church. And because we love the church, we are humbled when the church sins. Not a perfect analogy, but seeing as Paul has spoken about parents and children, it's probably worth using as a picture. But you know what it's like when you take your children when they're young, or even when they're old actually, but to a restaurant or something, and they misbehave in some way. You know, they throw their food on the floor. They don't tend to do that when they're older, but something like that. I remember the first time I was taking one of our children to a restaurant, you know, when they're very young, it's kind of your first attempt at going to a place where people are supposed to behave and be quiet and not throw their spoons around and stuff. And you're just so on edge, and it's so humiliating when they flick stuff around or start screaming loudly. And you're humble because of their misdemeanor. And Paul says, I feel like that about the church. I will be humbled by your sin. I'll be grieved by your sin. And the question for us is how do we feel about sin in the church? You know, of course, we're thankful that we haven't fallen into that particular sin, and we can be thankful to God for preserving us. And we can observe it as a wrong thing and kind of know what's wrong about the sin that's happening and maybe try and learn lessons from it and everything else. But Paul says something more than that. He says that I care. I will grieve about your sin. It will upset me. And that's a level of emotional commitment that sometimes we kind of shy back away from. If you've been in church leadership any length of time, you have known people that you love and care for and that you think are completely kind of with it as Christians. You know what I mean by with it. Fairly stable, following the Lord, and they fall. And sometimes it's very easy to have a kind of defense mechanism that you observe it, you know it happens theologically, and so you kind of quickly move on from it because you want to protect yourself from the kind of emotional hurt of that. And Paul's not like that. He says, I will be grieved. You know, I know in big plans of God that these things happen, and I know why people fall away, and I know that there needs to be discipline and all those things. We need to work through those things, but also he grieves. Something to do with church discipline on Tuesday evening, and we will think about, you know, the process and the right thing to do and those things. But in that, we've got to let ourselves grieve and be so sorry that sin has happened, that the Lord is not being followed as he should be. And there's a cost to that. There's a burden to that. Because we care about the church, because we love the church. Paul says, I'll feel it and it will humble me. Does it bother you when people backslide? Does it bother you when people fall into sin? Does it grieve you? When other churches suffer some major financial embarrassment or moral embarrassment, you know, there is a sense of, phew, praise God it wasn't us. But is there a much more than that, a sense of grief to say, this is terrible what's happening here. I care about it. It will humble me as the church is humbled in their sin. Because the identity of the church is bound up with my identity. So it's a pretty simple section, really, but it's a really challenging section, isn't it? Paul says to us, do you give yourself to the church? Regardless of whether they recognize all your gifts and all your calling, regardless of whether they have behaved right in the past to you, do you love the church so much that you want to give all of your possessions, all of yourself to them completely? And does the identity of the church so concern you that sin in individuals in the church or the failure of a particular church grieves you? You delight to see people walking in the truth, as John says, and you're sad to see people wandering from the truth. God grant we might love the church as Christ did and as Paul exemplified. Now, we haven't done this for a while, but there's an opportunity for 5 minutes. If you've got any questions or comments, could be about this evening's message, could be about any of the messages in 2 Corinthians, could be about one a few weeks ago where you thought, oh, I really wanted to ask a question about that, but didn't get the opportunity. It's all about strength in weakness. Paul, in different ways, explaining how his ministry demonstrates the strength of Christ, how he's not at all inferior to the apostles. He spends a long time talking about that. He talks about his travel plans and explains why they are part of him being transparent and being concerned for the gospel. Any questions?
Graham, it's maybe a strange question, but how have you guys found preparing and preaching from this book, because it seems to me that it's different to, let's say, Ephesians or other books where you have a doctrine and other practice. This is different, isn't it?
Yes, that's a good question. Thank you. It's been quite different to preaching 1 Corinthians. If that's, 1 Corinthians has lots of challenges in it, but it's in a sense a bit more conventional, might be the word, but that's not really the word because there isn't really convention. There's variety in the Bible, but. Yeah, it's more of that nature. 2 Corinthians is, in a way, a sustained discussion, explanation by Paul about his ministry. So that's a bit different in that his ministry comes out in other letters, but perhaps not quite in the same way. But 2 Corinthians, I suppose, is different in that sense, that it talks a lot about his ministry all the way through. That wasn't really the question, but how have we found it? I think we've found it challenging. There's been a few passages like this one where you first look at it and think, I'm not sure what's in this. This is Paul again talking about how he's distinct from the other apostles. So it's been really challenging, and it's been good for us to be forced to think, oh, I can't say exactly the same things again. God might just want me to say the same things again because he's repeating them, but it may be that there's a different point being made here about how Paul contrasts his ministry perhaps with those who are kind of boasting in Corinth. So I think we've found it helpful.
If Paul appointed the super apostles?
I don't think he did, no. No, I think it probably happened while Paul was not in Corinth, so I don't think he appointed people who were then kind of described. It's a sort of pejorative, not you know, insulting kind of terms. It may be what they called themselves. It may possibly be. It may be what the church in Corinth called them, but no, Paul didn't appoint them. No. No, I think they were about self-appointed, but perhaps appointed in the time that he was not there.
Was it what they taught, or just their whole presenting of his words?
Yeah.
Self-promotion. Yeah, they're kind of, what's the word?
Charisma.
I've lost it.
Yes. I think it was both. If you look at chapter 11, verse 4, he says, "For if someone comes to you and preaches a Jesus other than the Jesus we preached, or if you receive a different spirit from the one you received, or a different gospel from the one you accepted, you put up with it easily enough." So I think it was a bit more than just they were egotistical and money-grabbing. I think in the process they had distorted the gospel in ways. So yeah, I think it was more than just their character. I think the suggestion there is that they were preaching another Jesus. But of course that happens when you get megalomaniac church leaders, even if they sort of are still preaching the same gospel, in practice what they're preaching is a false gospel because they're preaching themselves, not Jesus in the end. So although they might be saying the right words most of the time, that in the end the effect is they're preaching a false Jesus. Is that fair, Nick? I'm just assuming you're an expert on every book of the Bible.
Well, I suppose that I think the two are going to go together,
yeah,
aren't they?
Yeah.
So no one who is self-promoting will in the end be preaching the true gospel, and anyone who's not preaching the true gospel, that would impact their character and show itself in their behaviour. And Jesus said about their truth.
Absolutely, yeah. That's helpful, thanks.
Perhaps a follow-up question could be, how do we draw the lines in the right places? Because there are those who will, maybe on some things, or they will teach things that are different to what we teach, but we want to embrace them, accept them, know they're part of God's church, welcome them. And then there are others that are a great danger to the church, like the super apostles, that we need to be wary of. Have you any thoughts from any series of how we near the end?
Yeah. Yeah. I think the core of the message, what Paul says in that bit I just quoted from, wherever I quoted it from, was it 11? 9? Yeah, thank you. About Jesus. It's very similar to what John in his letters talks about as apostasy, which is changing the message about the person of Jesus and the work of Jesus. So I think what we major on as a false gospel is anything that changes what the Bible teaches about who Jesus is, God's eternal Son, and what, become man, become flesh, and what Jesus does, dies to pay the penalty for sins, rises bodily, is resurrected bodily, returns to the Father, and offers forgiveness for all those who turn to him and judgment for all those who don't. And I think that's the core that John wants to preserve as the gospel and what Paul talks about when he talks about another Jesus. That's not to say that other things that the Bible teaches are not important, and it's not to say that it's not important to work out the wisest way to do church, or it's not important to try and work out, do the apostolic gifts of miracles and healing, healings and prophecy, do they continue? It's worth thinking about that and trying to understand that, but that's not really core to the gospel of Jesus Christ, who he is, why he came, and how we need to respond to that. So I think those things are core. I think the other category, we talked about it already, really, but when you're trying to assess other movements and other groups of churches, you want to work out, well, what are they saying about Jesus? How much they're saying about Jesus? Is it centered around Jesus? But you also look at character. What are they driven by? What values do they adopt? And I think that's quite helpful sometimes in assessing other movements. From the outside, what does it look like? What's prominent in what I see? Is it the values of that were similar to these apostles in Corinth, where success and drama and power seem to be the most prevalent values, rather than weakness and reliance on the power of God and faith and suffering through to glory? Are those the prominent features of the church? So I think you made me think about those two things. Another question? Different question?
Can you give a definition for what an apostle is? And do we still have apostles today?
It's funny you should say that. I was thinking someone might ask that question, so I prepared for that question. But having prepared, I still wasn't quite sure what the answer was. The word seems to get used in two ways in the New Testament. There are the 12 apostles who became 11, then were reinstated as 12 in Acts 2. And then Paul, who considers himself an apostle, but as he describes it, as abnormally born, as an unusual apostle. So the word, I think, gets used of those who have seen the risen Christ and who are commissioned and sent by Jesus. And he would see himself as being that kind of apostle. In that sense, the word apostle, though, it just means sent one, and it does get used elsewhere of people who are sent out sort of on a mission, either by the church or ultimately by Jesus. So sometimes the word does get used of people who are not the 13, if you like, but I think the 13 are in a special category, and I think. If you think about Ephesians, that it talks about the church being built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets. So whether you talk about the 13 precisely, or whether you just talk about that whole period, there was the apostolic period when there were those sent out by Christ. There was the word that they brought, which is the foundation on which the church is built. And I think in that sense, that's not repeated. That apostolic period is not repeated. Because you can't have a foundation again. You can't somewhere up in the middle suddenly have another apostolic foundation that's now building something slightly different. So I think the apostolic period ended as the scriptures were completed. Is that any good as an answer?
Can you still call somebody an apostle?
I don't think it's...
These false apostles, people
were
called apostles that weren't 13.
Yeah. You can certainly call them false apostles. or super apostles. Whether it's a helpful term, I wouldn't fall out over it as being used as a term, but I think it's probably not a helpful term because it in most people's minds more calls to mind the apostolic period rather than the period we're in now, I think, where the scriptures have been complete. So I don't think it... I think it tends to give someone an authority that is not warranted. Just in preparing for that, the possibility of that question, and just looking at some websites, if you type in something like, what are the signs of the apostle, you get a whole load of churches that would be into the kind of apostolic ministries. And the problem with that is that if you show those signs, you then have an authority, which I don't think is in the Bible, that there are people now who have a kind of particular authority. That if I start calling myself Apostle Graham rather than Graham, Mr. Graham, then there's a danger that you then start to view me differently as having an extra authority, a sort of divine authority that's beyond the Word of God. Apostle Graham said, it's just as bad sometimes using other terms, but anyway, yeah. Thank you, good question. Hi, Liz.
My question is, I was very much challenged by the first point of your sermon.
Oh, good, I'm glad someone was challenged by the first point. that was the weaker point.
About how much you love the church, and I guess how you know that you love the church.
Yeah.
And you kind of touched on it, that we tend to think of it as a kind of balance and an economy and how much time and money have I got and how much can I reasonably give.
Yeah.
And I guess just like how do you think that through without being,
burned out, yeah.
But also
yeah, I think it's really helpful to think how you would be as a parent, as Paul does, and to think, actually, when you're in the family, you don't begrudge paying for your children's stuff. So of course you use godly wisdom and you say, I love my children, but I'm not going to stay up every night because they're a bit disturbed. I'm going to work out an economy where I can sleep. So I'll get some patterns in place because it'll help them and it'll help me. And I won't buy them every single toy and I won't indulge them. And I know there may be other reasons why you don't want to indulge them but even if the toy or the book would help them, you don't buy them everything. You have a limit. But you don't calculate in the same way. And I suppose the question I'm raising is, if you applied the same logic to the church that you did to your family, that would be revolutionary. That, of course, there'd be limits, because you've got to live, and like there is with your family, like you still go out to work, you don't give all your time to your children or your wife or anything else, but you don't begrudge any time given, and you try and give as much as you can, and you say, I will gladly spend myself. We're selfish in families as well, but as a default, you want to give yourself to your wife and your children and your grandchildren if you have them. You don't think about it. You don't think, you just kind of do it, don't you? And I suppose that's the kind of attitude that you'd want in terms of the church. Is that beginning to answer a bit? You could think of other things like, is it hurting? That's probably good. Not so much always what have I done in a sort of self-satisfied way, but what am I willing to do? Do I miss them when I'm not around them? You miss gathering with the church for a couple of weeks. Do you think, okay. Or do you think, I really miss that. I really miss being with them and I wonder how they're getting on. Like you would with your family. If you don't see your family for a few weeks, you think, oh, it'd be nice to see them. Do you think that about the church? Or do you just think, oh, I'll go back again, it's got nothing to do this Sunday. And, similarly, when you think about what you can give of your possessions and your time, you don't think I can serve in every single ministry of the church. You're probably not gifted to do them all anyway, but you'd burn yourself out. But you do think, well, it'd be nice if I could serve somewhere. I'm not thinking, oh, I'll do it if I have to. I'm thinking, I really want to, because I love these guys. So something like that. It's probably not helping. It's probably a bit too high level still, but might help a little bit. Sorry? It's come down a little bit. Yes, Nick?
There is the book Serving Without Sinking.
Yeah. If you're listening online, Serving Without Sinking is a book. I can't remember who it's by, but we did recommend it a couple of years ago. Yeah, you'll find it's...
John Lennon.
Yeah, it could be. Serving Without Sinking. Yeah. I hope you've seen as we've been through 2 Corinthians that even though it's a lot about ministry, it's not really about ministers. So it's not like, you know, here's a handbook for people who are paid by the church or leading the church, you know, elders in the church or something. It's not a handbook for that. It's about all of our ministry in the church, but it's also about our attitude to the church, and it's about our reliance on God and not on our own strength. That's what 2 Corinthians is helping us see. We see it through the model that Paul is giving us. So you do have to kind of think about ministry and gospel ministry, leading churches and preaching and stuff like that. But it's not like that's out there and that's nothing to do with a lot of you guys who are not, you know, regularly preaching or whatever. It's giving you the model that then makes you think about the church and helps you think about how we all minister in weakness, relying on God. And that's how Paul was, that's how we should be.